Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that you can go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, we have our interesting customers pop in to rent something. We talk about the exciting things that they have going on in their lives, and we're always keen to hear what films that they've loved across their life. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop. How's it? Welcome to the video store. Thank you for wandering in. My name is Russell. We're not working behind the counter here. I am the owner of The Bioscope, which is an independent cinema here in Johannesburg. And usually it is just those working at the video store who are chilling behind the counter, and we are talking about the films in the series that we're loving. But every now and again, we have ourselves a very special guest episode. Today is one of those episodes. A good friend of mine by the name of Zach Ackers is going to pop in to rent something. He is an American who I was very lucky to meet when we were just pipsqueaks back at university, and there was a great exchange program between NYU and the university I went to, which was WITS, and it was always great getting to know and meet these incredible students that were giving up 6 months of their life in arguably the most exciting city in the world to come to Johannesburg. And it was very cool to keep in touch with them and see the success that all of them have achieved, including Zach, who went on to be one of the co-writers of the film Him, which is now in cinemas, including the Bioscope. This is the Jordan Peele-produced horror starring Marlon Wayans. And as you said, tickets are available for screenings at the Bioscope, which is thebioscope.co.za. For those who know Zach, we hope that this is an interesting chat where we get to perhaps uncover a bit more and get to hear some of the films that he's loved across his life. But for all of those that come through and pop into the video store every week, I think you're going to enjoy this one because it's really cool to talk specifically about writers and writing and what it takes to produce a film like this. All right, let's get into it. This is Zach Ackers popping in to rent something. How's it going?
it's going really well. I've never experienced this before, creating something that is everywhere. It's like being advertised everywhere.
Yeah.
And your name is everywhere, and like that aspect of it is really bizarre. When I went to New York last week, and just like there's a billboard in Times Square.
Yeah.
And it has your name on it, and just like, wow, that's a different experience.
It's lovely, man. And I want to get into it all. I want to map the whole thing. But firstly, how long has it been since you and I hung out? When was that year in WITS?
That was 18 years ago.
That was 18 years ago.
Okay. That was 2007. Yeah.
Okay.
That was when I was in South Africa.
And I distinctly remember at the time that you were busy writing your first novel, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I was writing. I had forgotten about that. I was writing a novel, yeah.
And I distinctly remember it, and I'm sure these were words out of your mouth. It was like, it doesn't have to be a good one, but I need to do it. It was like a deadline or a goal more than it was anything else. Was that right?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I think that's probably true for anything I've written, where it's like, it's just like, I need to do it because it's in my brain right now and I need to get it out, if for no other reason than to do that, to stop thinking about it. And I had totally forgotten that, but you're right.
What happened to that?
A lot of ideas of that turned into a screenplay that I wrote with my brother that, uh, it, you know, it was like unproduced, nothing happened with it, but it morphed into something that it was totally different, but it did like evolve into a finished piece of something, which was interesting.
Lovely. And I think that's the thing I'd love to get across the most, especially on this big scale, is how things morph and how things change and what it's like to be a writer for what is now a big Hollywood movie and how that, and how that all works. Where are you right now?
I'm in Massachusetts.
Okay.
You know, just like in the middle of nowhere, Massachusetts. And I ended up here because I was living in New York and I was living in Brooklyn with my wife. And we had a 1-year-old son when the pandemic happened.
Oh, shit.
And it was one of those things where it was like, we're in an apartment with a 1-year-old who like is very active, and like we can't go anywhere, we can't move. So we went to stay with her parents here in Massachusetts, where my wife is from. And, you know, they have a house with a yard. So it was like, we'll just stay here and ride it out for a few weeks. And then, of course, we were there for months. And my partner and I, my business partner and I, worked remotely to write, you know, what became Shipworm, the podcast. And it worked well. And it was just one of those things that was like, oh, I guess I can live here.
Yeah.
You know, I guess I can live here and we can do this work. So we just settled here, which is good because like my wife's family is all around here. And so my kids are growing up with grandparents and uncles and aunts and cousins and all that. And we have a yard, which is great.
No, I'm feeling that exact same thing. I've got a kid on the way.
Oh, so congratulations.
Thanks, man. So yeah, early next year. And so we also are living in an apartment here in Joburg and also going like, we want a garden. So I totally get it. So do you feel you're a little shielded from what might happen with him?
Yes.
Are you going to do any kind of traveling or is it something that you've sort of passed on at this point? Where are you at in the next sort of few weeks to a month?
I am just going to stay here and settle and just sort of see what it feels like. I think that the distance from it is healthy, you know, in a lot of ways, because, you know, for good and for bad, I think one of the most important things that I've learned in just, you know, working in and around this industry for a few years is like, everything is sort of rat poison and everything is sort of a trap in a way. It means that you can buy into the good and you can buy into the bad and you can kind of go down those tunnels either direction.
Interesting.
And I think that staying level and focusing on the next job is the only way to survive.
I think it's interesting because definitely with film, it's very much a director's medium. So I think everything is now on the shoulders of, it's Justin, eh? Justin Tipping.
Yeah, Justin Tipping, yeah.
Because you just right until the end are cutting and editing and making these decisions. I'm sure you'll agree with me, but I loved hearing this from somewhere, which was that film is very much the director's medium. TV and perhaps other sort of things similar, like perhaps podcasting and stuff. But TV in general is the writer's medium. Because you hear those stories of like the sitcoms where the writers are listening to the laughs and the dress rehearsals and furiously making the changes and doing all of that. And then something like theater is the actor's medium where the writer's long gone. The director has sometimes left the city by the time the play starts, because it's really much up to you on that stage. Do you know your lines? Right. Can you deliver? Or if you change it, that's up to you, you know?
Right.
So I've got a feeling that, well, I'm curious to find out, and we'll get into it however much you feel comfortable, but I'm sure your original thinking of him has perhaps changed quite dramatically to the final result.
Yes.
What was your original seed and idea And when was that? I'm always curious to know the timelines of just something like him specifically.
Believe it. So the original idea actually, so my company is called 2UP, and it is Skip Bronchi and myself, and that's our company.
I have to say that that's one of the coolest names.
Yeah. It's actually like the story of where that name comes from is actually from a movie that I am happy to talk about in this show. So it's like it's a weird thing, but it comes from a movie and that's where we got our name.
I'm actually saying specifically the name Skip. Skip Bronchi is a particularly cool name. I'd love to hear the story behind the production the company's name. But Skip, I mean, is that like on his ID?
His actual name is Robert Bronchi, but it's like a family name. So
it's a very American thing. Yeah.
There's multiple Roberts going back generations. And so like his mom was like, well, name him Robert, but I'm calling him Skip. And that was just immediately like his name, you know, like that was the name. So technically no, but yes, you know, his whole life he's Skip.
That's cool. It's a cool name. Okay. So the two of you were putting this together, right? Okay,
yeah. He was watching a documentary on Tiger Woods that came out on HBO a few years ago. It's really well done. And there was this famous scene or this famous moment in his life where he won the 2008 US Open on a broken leg. Like he, on the first hole, he takes a swing and falls over.
Oh, shit. And, I didn't remember that. Yeah.
And his caddy was just like, well, we need to stop. Like, if you're in this much pain, we should stop. And he basically was like, there's no way I'm stopping. I'm going to keep playing. And for the next 4 days, he played on a broken leg. And it was like every single swing was like pure pain. And he won. He won that tournament. And Skip sort of saw that and was like, this is a horror movie. This is like body horror.
Yeah.
Right? That someone would do this to themselves. And it just that moment turned into like, when was the last sports horror movie? Like, what is that? What movie exists like that?
And,
you know?
And so I have to interject. I've been able to see the movie as an exhibitor, so before everyone else. And so I was sitting in the room with other guys who, watch movies every day for the major cinema chains. And we've all gotten to know each other. Over the years of sort of seeing each other, I think I see them more than I see some of my family. And as it ended, I turned around and I said, "There you have it, folks, the first sports horror." When we finished watching him, and because in my head immediately I was like, "We've never seen this."
Yeah, the only example that we could think of was Black Swan, which is like a little bit different, it was one of those things where it's like it's in an athletic world but that was a movie that was critically and, audience acclaimed, like, you know, it made money and people loved it. So it was one of those things that was like, oh, we should do this. And no one has done it to this extent in a sport like this, you know, and football, American football, so naturally is horrific, you know, it's like it is horror, like every single play ends in a car crash. So it's like it was a very easy thing to sort of like, and especially I think that the way that Americans embrace it and embrace the values of it and sort of like map American values onto a horrific thing like that was very fascinating. You know, that the fact that we cheer when players play through injury when players get hit, when there's a huge collision, that's like something we're like, oh wow, look at that hit, you know. It is exhilarating. It is very like gladiator. You know, it's like one step down from like actual like death match sort of thing. But it is sort of treated like religion in this country, and yeah, that's totally interesting. And so it was very easy to sort of like step into that and sort of like live in it and twist it, you know?
Okay.
So that, but we, so we wrote that script, I believe, and it, like, I think it was 2022.
Okay.
When we turned in like the here's our script sort of thing. Yeah. And so it has been that long to get from script to where we are at this point, which is actually relatively quick.
Yeah, yeah. No, sometimes it can take a decade. But had you been asked to write it, or was this a script?
It was a pure spec script. We wrote it on our own, and we, you know, at that point we had representation because of, you know, Limetown, the podcast that we wrote, that sort of like set off our career.
I want to dial back to Limetown and hear more about it and some of the previous stuff. But okay, so you found yourself at a point where you had some representation that you just trusted were able to try and get it in the right hands, and then you sort of leave it up to them, right?
Yeah. So they sent it out to a bunch of production companies, and pretty quickly it became clear that it was going to sell, which was the biggest question for us, you know, like, because you, when you write on spec, it's like you're writing for free.
Yeah,
you're not making any money. And so it was the biggest thing to us is like, can we sell this and make money? And it became pretty apparent that a lot of companies were interested. Cool. And then when we got the information that Monkey Paw was interested, it was like, well, I mean,
no brainer. Yeah, this is Jordan Peele,
right?
Who's right. Yeah, lovely.
It's the biggest name in horror saying that he wants to make your horror movie, and so it was one of those things where it was like, it just felt like a natural fit for what we were doing. So at that point, it was pretty easy what direction we wanted to go in, and so that's how that sort of happened.
And then is it basically one check? Is it basically like one
sale? The way that it, there are always steps in how these things work. And so there's the initial like purchase price of the script, and then there are sort of guaranteed writing steps. Like you will get a revision and a polish sort of thing. And they can be broken down in all sorts of ways and used in all different sorts of ways. But each time you turn in a new draft, there's another payment that comes in. And then there's also, you know, if the movie gets made, there's another step that you're paid. And if the movie is successful, there's more. So it's like it's very segmented in how it pays out sort of thing.
I love the idea of what should be obvious, but the step of will it get made or does it get made? Exactly. Because I think that's what a lot of people don't know happens, and maybe you can speak more to this, but a lot of scripts just get bought and they just sit on a shelf.
Yeah, a lot of people have whole careers, successful careers, with big houses and, you know, like everything, and never have anything produced like that, you know? They can sell a lot of scripts, they can do a lot of rewrites, they can do a lot of sort of ghostwriting projects. You know, there's a lot of people who have careers doing that. So it is.
What's ghostwriting?
Well, just sort of like being hired to do revisions, but not credited, essentially. Yeah. And that happens sometimes. Like, you know, someone will be brought in to do like a polish on a specific character. Like, we need this character to be more funny, or we need, you know, we need this scene to be scarier. Okay. And they'll bring someone in to do that. And the work doesn't constitute giving them a full credit.
Yeah.
And so they are paid for their work sort of thing.
As we're talking about writing and credits and all the different ways that this can be, I had to almost think about it, but the posters and the billboards and the poster that's for him out in the lobby right now has your guy's name quite big.
Yeah.
And it was, and for a second I was like, is that because I know Zach that I'm just conscious of this? And then I look at all the other posters in the lobby and they're all like tiny little credits in that credit font, you know, which is that like really thin, how do we fit as many credits in, but their name is on the poster. But your names, you and Skip, are quite specifically there. How did that happen? Or what is that? What is happening there that just makes that different to other posters?
I think that part of that, you know, some of that can be negotiated in a contract, you know, especially because it is an original script. It's not like a piece of IP. It's not anything like that. Yeah. So it is our original idea. And so it's easier to sort of negotiate those things. But also I think, you know, a company like Monkey Paw values artists in that way, you know, where it's like, we want to feature the creatives behind this.
I mean, I think it's amazing. I think it's great. And I was so happy for you, but I was just wondering, you know, I mean, was it the name that you guys had created for yourself? And that was a nice selling point.
I don't think anyone knows who we are, really.
You know?
You know, like, I think we might have a reputation with people in the industry and they're fans of like our previous work, but you know, the world at large has no idea who we are. We don't really add anything to the project. I do think that this is sort of like, because it was an original idea of ours.
That's cool.
And because Monkey Paw, again, values the people who do these sorts of things, I think it was a choice that was made, you know, that, you know, obviously is good for us. You know?
Yeah, no, it's great. And I mean, I can feel it in the water that we're post the whole big Marvel world. And I just think we're getting tired of that, of the sequels and the reboots. And I just think it just took a movie like Sinners this year to kind of shine through. One of my highlights last year was something like Blink Twice, where all of a sudden, it's not just that they're original, but it's that they're original and they're good.
right.
And I just think we're just, you know, the fact that we're both in agreement that there's just no such thing as a sports horror, that we just know we're in this like uncharted, very cool, very unique territory. And I think based solely on that is enough reason to get out and see it. Then once you're in it, and just to speak about my experience of watching this film, I was like, it's fucking awesome. It's really great. It's very cool. And I want to just talk about the film specifically, and I'm curious to just touch on some of whether or not that was there in the writing in the beginning. But what I loved about it is that it felt like a fever dream, but it actually wasn't a dream.
Right.
Like the moments of horror, and I don't think I'm giving anything in the way, and I don't want to give plot points away, but it was cool to feel how real the horror was, and that it wasn't this kind of my fucked up head and my psychology. Is that right? Is that something that you felt was a thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the fun of the movie is that your protagonist is someone who is experiencing brain trauma. Right. Which sort of like speaks to the sport itself, that, you know, it's like, you know, it's essentially like CTE, the horror movie, in a lot of ways, where it's like, you know, these guys experience trauma to their brain every single game that they play. And so I think that the nature of it leads to experiencing things like real things in sort of an unusual way, where it's like you lose track of time, you lose track of self in some ways. And I think that allows for that sort of fever dream experience that you're talking about. And it sort of speaks to sort of like the larger point of it, which was like, these are sort of like damaged individuals trying to navigate life. You know,
no,
and like that aspect of it was interesting to me.
And in a way, it's almost not a sports movie.
Right.
Sports
right.
just the sort of catalyst for it, because there are other movies that are very much a sports movie. It's about
right.
you know, succeeding in sport. But this is a very, like, personal thing. And it's about, your own legacy, the own idea and that pressure of greatness and the pressure of succeeding. It's got a lot more to it, which is great.
Yeah, but I mean, the interesting thing is that I love sports. I'm a big sports fan. I'm a fan of American football, huge fan of American football. I'm deeply conflicted about that, but I love the sport and I watch it. But I do not like sports movies, generally speaking. And it's because, to me, there's a very apparent formula. There's a very apparent structure to them that I think feels exhausting in a lot of ways, where it's like, okay, these are the beats you're supposed to hit. This is what you're supposed to do. So the idea of writing a sports movie was not attractive to me.
Yeah.
But the idea of writing this kind of sports movie was, because it's like you said, it's not really about sports. It's about being a person, and specifically, like, the things that you have to do to be the best at something. Why? What?
Yeah. And at what cost?
It's like, what do you get at the end? Okay, now you're the best. Now what? And it's really just sort of like a matter of waiting until you're not, you know, and then when you're not anymore, who are you? What is your identity? Like, what do you do at that point? And that's fascinating to me. The athlete's life is very interesting to me, because it's like, especially like the ones who reach the highest level, because at a certain point as an athlete, you die.
Yeah.
And then what? And so it's like, they're kind of like this rare kind of human that experiences a whole entire life, and then they have to live another life.
So, and it's not,
and
like,
how do you, yeah. So that's always been fascinating to me.
It's not like they're Keith Richards, where you can keep playing guitar literally until you Ozzy Osbourne in a chair. But for athletes, it's like, yeah, you have to bow out, and you bow out so early in your life.
Yes, exactly. You're in your 30s, and then, like, you have to live the rest of your life.
Fuck do you do? And if you can't speak, if you can't do public speaking,
you're right. Exactly.
There's no commentating, or there's no, like, career for you.
The things that you become a coach, you become a commentator, but at a certain point, you can't recreate the high of that, the rush of doing something that few people can, and being recognized for it. And then the rest of your life, you're just another guy. You are like everyone else, you know? And so that in itself is, like, interesting to me, to sort of, like, deal in the world of people who live and die and then keep living, you know, like that is an interesting space to sort of, like,
cool
play in, you know?
And so a nice device for those who, don't know the nitty gritties of the film, is that it takes place over the course of a few days. The whole film is about one guy in particular who is on the cusp of being the next great American footballer, and is invited to this, like, special training camp with who's considered the greatest footballer of all time. And he's going to, like, train him over the course of a few days. So the whole film takes place in this kind of quite interesting space age looking building where you're not quite sure what's in all the doors and around the passages. It felt a little bit like the movie Ex Machina.
Yes.
You know, where the main character goes away to this.
That was a huge structural inspiration for this film, for sure. Cool. That was definitely like, oh, this should be Ex Machina, this movie, you know.
Cool. Cool.
Like that was definitely a huge inspiration.
But at the start, our main character gets this, like, head injury.
Yeah.
So you sort of constantly sort of aware of this sort of wound in his head, and it's lovely. Okay, it's cool. Do you want to perhaps touch on where the film departs from your original idea? Does the essence kind of still remain intact?
I think the essence of it still remains. that, you know, like I don't want to speak too much on that. I mean, it's just there were, you know, they made a lot of decisions, but sort of like within the structure that had already been established. So okay. It's, you know, it's, yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Let's dial back. What was Limetown? Because I remember from, you know, just the relationship one has after you left NYU, we stay in touch on Facebook, and Facebook was really good for kind of keeping in touch on all those things. And I could pick up there was some lovely success with that. What was that?
So that was a podcast that Skip and I developed. It was, you know, like the story of that sort of like, you know, Skip and I met in college, and we became good friends and roommates. And then he produced my senior thesis film that I wrote and directed. And it was one of those things where the creative partnership was like, so obvious. It's like, oh, we should work together. We should do this. And then of course we didn't. He went to the opposite side of the country and I was in New York, and we each had our own careers. He worked at Facebook and Pinterest, and he was doing sort of commercial brand work there. And I was doing sports documentaries in New York. And every like few months we would just, you know, be like, we should work together. We should do something. We should work together. We should do something. And then one day in like 2013, I was on the subway going to work, which I did every single day. And I had my headphones on and I was listening to, you know, some podcast. And I was looking around and I noticed that everyone else on the train had their headphones on and they were listening to something. And I was sort of like, this is an audience that you can sort of tap into.
Totally.
You know, like we should do something in the space. And at that point, there weren't any sort of like narrative fiction podcasts that existed. And so I sort of reached out to Skip and I was like, why can't we do something like do like a film or a series like in the podcast form, like, and tell a big story, you know, using audio sort of thing. And he was like, I don't know. Let's try. So, you know, that's when we started writing and developing this idea of Limetown. And it was sort of like, it was one of those things where it was like, I was taking a shower and it's like a whole town disappeared. It's like, why? I don't know. You know, like that's kind of like how it starts.
It was original fiction. Hey, it wasn't based on a true story.
It was completely original, but it was like, we pretty early on were like, what worked in the podcast space was like at that point, like This American Life, Radio Lab.
It was,
you know,
the true
like
crimey stuff. Yeah.
True. Yeah. Where it's very like, you know, it is a journalist reporting on things and telling you a story with sound bites. And so it was like, okay, well, we can play within that structure and just create a whole fictional idea using that conceit. Right.
Okay.
But
you had the big sort of initial idea, which was, you say, a whole town disappears.
A whole town disappeared. Yeah. Okay. Why? I don't know. And so like that sort of like sent us down this rabbit hole of creation and whatever. You know, we developed it, wrote a pilot. And at some point, and this was like 2013 into 2014, Skip called me and it was just like, in a year from now, I'm going to leave my job and I'm going to start a company and I want you to be in it.
Cool.
Will you do that a year from now?
Cool. A man with reasonable deadlines.
Yeah. And he was just like, you can think about it. You can talk to, your wife. And I was like, I'm in.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, of course I'll do it. And so, you know, these things sort of coincided where it was August of 2015. We had about 6 months worth of runway and enough money to sort of like invest into, you know, like an indie feature or to start commercial work, or we can invest in this podcast that we've been developing.
Okay.
And it felt very risky, but it was one of those things that's like, let's do this because it's exciting to us. We don't know what it is really. And it feels like it's filling a void of some kind. Right.
Yeah.
So we decided to go down that path. We put our money into the pilot of that podcast. And we kind of had a map for the rest of the series, but we hadn't done anything else. And we sent that pilot around to like all these podcasting companies that existed then, being like, hey, what do you think? What are you interested in this? And everyone either ignored us or said like, this is not what we do, right? That, yeah. Like we don't do fictional things like this. So we decided to put it out on our own.
Yeah.
It was one of those things where it's like maybe 10,000 people listen to this. Maybe it's like a calling card that we can use to meet other people sort of thing. And that was sort of our expectation for it. And then I remember I was watching whatever Mission Impossible movie was out in 2015 with my parents. And I started getting like texts to my phone. It was like, it kept buzzing. And I was looking and Skip was like, we were featured on the homepage of Apple Podcasts. Like,
cool.
Which at that time was sort of like
that means
the biggest thing that could possibly happen. Cause that's where all the traffic is. And I remember being in shock. And I was in shock for like an hour. I was totally out of my head because I realized in that moment that our life was different. Like things had changed.
Mm.
And I give myself credit because I was actually right. You know, it was sort of like the turning point of our career because all of a sudden it became this thing that grew beyond us sort of organically. We had a lot of people listening. And at that point it was like, oh shit, now we actually have to make the rest of this show.
I hope you'd thought through the end. Because with these big ideas, it's sometimes like, did you think it through?
We did. We had thought it through to the end, but we didn't have anything written.
Sure,
you know? So
sure.
It was like, and so for the next like 4 months was just writing and casting and producing this show sort of in real time and
all in audio, which is really interesting, right?
Yeah. And it became the number one podcast on iTunes after our second episode. And that was when we started getting interest from like everyone. Like we had publishing companies, we had production companies, we had WME, our agency, reach out. And all of our attitude was like, this is cool, we still have to make the show.
Yeah, let's like, not lose
like
focus
we're in
here,
the
yeah.
middle of making this show. And so we did it, and it went over really well, and we got into the agency, and then that allowed us to sort of out of Limetown we got a novel deal, and out of Limetown we were able to make a TV show with Jessica Biel and Stanley Tucci on Facebook Watch, which doesn't exist anymore.
Well, I remember that. I was going to go on to say that I remember hearing about that.
Yeah.
And that was it was obviously a noble effort on Facebook to like give it a swing.
Yeah. I'm very proud of like how that show turned out. And, you know, we got great experience working on a TV show. But unfortunately, like as soon as that season wrapped, they were like, we are no longer a platform.
Yeah, no, sure.
So that happened. But, you know, it was a great experience for us.
Did you get a chance to get any firsthand time or experience with those actors?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, you were speaking about TV as a writer's medium. It was...
Mm.
Because we owned the IP of Limetown, we were involved the whole way. I think if we didn't own it, like if early on someone else had purchased it from us or whatever, we would never have been involved at all. But we were in the writer's room. We were on set every day. We were in post-production.
The TV show, the Facebook Watch TV show, was that the TV adaptation of Limetown? What was that?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Yeah, we adapted the first season of the podcast to the TV show. And yeah, okay. We got to work in it the whole time. And it was a great experience. It was what you're talking about, where in the moment we need a new line. And you just sit and you figure it out with the actors. I mean, like, one of my favorite experiences working on that show was there was a big scene. There's a big scene with Jessica Biel and Stanley Tucci that sort of was like the only time they meet all season.
Yeah.
And before we were shooting, I was sitting in a tiny like barber shop with them that was attached to like the diner that we were shooting in. And we just sat there and we hashed out the scene over an hour, just like sitting there like, okay, how do you feel about this? Like, this is what we're trying to set, you know, and like we got it where everyone was happy. And like being able to sit in a room and just like work it out with people that talented was like, you know, one of the more exhilarating experiences of my life, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that was a wonderful experience.
He seems lovely.
He is. He's
I don't know.
He's amazing.
There's enough of Stanley Tucci outside of cinema, like the cooking and the recipe books and all of that. He certainly seems like a lovely dude.
He's amazing. One of my favorite stories from that time was I think it was literally the first day we were shooting with him. He had this big monologue that sort of like talked about, you know, like his ability. He's a character who can read people's minds. And so like he hears people's thoughts, like whether he wants to or not, sort of thing. And so he's talking about that with the character, and it's this long monologue. And, you know, it's our first day shooting with him. I'm nervous. I'm like standing around behind the camera watching everything. And he delivers this, and then he just kind of looks over after the scene is done. And he goes, "Who wrote this shit?" and like, you know, it's a joke, like, you know, everybody's laughing, but it was like, it was immediately like a very endearing thing. And he was very complimentary to me and very sort of like supportive of our work. So it was like, but it was just like, oh man, he's busting my chops. It's Stanley Tucci. You
know? That's great. You've walked into our video store here. Is there something that you are returning? Is there something that you've watched recently that you want to talk about?
I'm returning Misery, which I just watched.
The Kathy Bates adaptation of the Stephen King book.
From 1990. Yeah.
I know about it. I've never seen it.
I had never seen it either. Okay. Which is, I'm actually in like a movie club with my friends that we've been maintaining on Zoom since the pandemic. So more than 5 years, and we've watched, you know, like 170 movies or whatever.
Oh, that's cool. Do you give yourself a movie a week or something?
It was a movie a week, and now it's a movie every other week because, you know, like people have more time, have more things than they did during the pandemic. But this round was job movies that are about jobs.
Okay. I love that you got categories. I think that's very cool.
Yeah. And so like it helps to pick movies when you have categories like that. And so I selected Misery because I was like, oh, it's about a novelist, you know, among other things, it's about being a writer. And it's a really like, it's a kind of movie that doesn't get made now, you know, but it's just like two people in a tight space giving great performances, and it's very tense and unnerving and interesting, and it's written by William Goldman. So there's like a lot of like elevated elements to it.
Who was the male lead?
It's James Caan.
James Caan. Okay. And he's a writer, and then she's a fan, right? And she kidnaps
she's
him.
His number one fan. Yeah. And so he has this car crash in the beginning, and she saves him, and she brings him to her house and sort of nurses him back to health. His legs are shattered. His shoulders dislocated. Like he's on the verge of death. Okay. And it's in the middle of this blizzard that he crashes. And so she has this good sort of story of, we can't get you to the hospital. The phones are down. I will nurse you back to health. By the way, I'm your number one fan.
Coincidence? Yeah.
And it just sort of like escalates from there. And she gives one of the best performances you'll ever see.
She won the Oscar for it.
She did. And she was the first actress to win an Academy Award from the horror category for best for best actress. And it was her first kind of movie that she'd ever done. I mean, part of her casting was, we need to cast someone who's sort of like unknown to the audience, that she's not carrying any baggage to this that people already have. It's she's an unknown. And so that I think at the time was sort of like, I don't know this actress. What is she going to do? And then you're like, oh, she's insane.
And she's incredible. I'm busy reading Stephen King at the moment, actually. Have you seen Life of Chuck?
I have not seen it, no, but I've heard great things about it.
Okay, I'm going to rent that for you. I'm going to hand it to you now over the counter. It's great. It's also Stephen King. And I think what they've, what everyone, including Stephen King, has tried to convey, that he's more than just horror. And so this is a short story. It was part of a collection called If It Bleeds, something about If It Bleeds. And it's one of the sort of four shorts in this book. And it's great. A story of a guy's life told in three parts, but you get the third act first. It goes backwards.
I see.
But it's magical. Oh, it's magical. And there's just these one or two moments where I remember just getting what we call the gooies here on the video store, which is just like, just feels like someone just turned on, like, your stomach's a microwave and it just sort of turned on, where you're like, oh. Because there's this one scene in particular that I really hope would be like, will go down as like an iconic scene in cinema, which is when old Tom Hiddleston is dancing to this drummer.
Yeah.
But when you watch the movie, once I've rented it to you now, you'll see it's magical.
And it's Mike Flanagan, right?
It's Mike Flanagan. That so movie. That's also another guy who is bringing a sort of history of horror, but is going, I'm not doing horror this time. Same as Stephen King. So both of them are, they know how to do horror, and there's like one or two tiny little moments that sort of just remind you, like, these guys know how to do horror, but it's not a scary movie in any ways.
Yeah, it's one of those frustrations that I have with sort of like how people view writing in general, and maybe like artists in general, but it's like something that we've had to do at every step in sort of like the life of our company is prove ourselves. Like, you know, it was, you can't write TV. You wrote a podcast, you can't write TV. It's like, okay, now you wrote TV, but you can't write film.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, but then we write film. You know, and even within film, it's like, you wrote a horror movie, you can't write another movie. And it's like, and so like, if you can write, if you can tell a story, it translates to other things if you want it to most of the time. And someone like Stephen King is obviously capable of anything. And and so I think that applies to Mike Flanagan as well. You know, like, he's a very talented guy and he can do what he wants to do. And I'm happy he's sort of expanding his portfolio a little bit.
How did you approach writing horror? Like, what were some of the sort of things you reminded yourself or each other when you were like, this needs to be a scary scene? Like, what do you, like, where do you dig for that?
I've always, in my whole life, I've always had access to darkness. And it's very surprising to people when they, because like, I'm a normal, happy person. But I think because I am happy and I do have like strong familial and friendship ties, and I've always felt safe. That means that I have been able to explore darkness creatively a lot. And I remember in kindergarten, I was pulled into the principal's office with my parents, or with my mom, and they had drawings that I had done, and it was like monsters and blood and like all that, and they were like, is everything okay at home? And my mom was just like, yes, like I don't, like, she was just like, I don't know, like, he's interested in this, and you know, I was just like, yeah, it's interesting to me. But people thought, you know, there was like abuse, or there, you know, like, I was being neglected. But it was like, I was a perfectly happy child But I was always fascinated with it.
And so do you think it's because you, yeah, because you come from a safe place, literally and figuratively, you know you can venture far out,
yes,
knowing that you can come back. Where I would imagine someone who does have a very tough life and has experienced trauma and darkness doesn't want to live in that. They actually want to fantasize about the idyllic thing. So their brain is, if anything, their brain's probably trying to normalize that trauma, get shut it away, put it in a box and lock the key. Is that right?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I also think, you know, I have also since then experienced life, and life is hard and trauma happens, and you lose people that you don't want to lose, and you sort of like experience the horrors of the world. And there is a part of me that doesn't enjoy living in that space as much, but I also think I lean that way creatively because horror allows you to experiment in storytelling more than almost any other genre, and in a way that's accessible. Like, audiences want to see you explore, and the people who pay for your movies want to see it in that space. And it's like why you see a lot of these auteurs leaning or starting in that place, because you know, I mean, you think of a movie like Weapons that came out this year by Zach Cregger. Like, that movie is so experimental structurally.
Yeah.
And it's something that you couldn't really get away with in any other genre except for horror.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of it. But I also think what I like about it the most is that horror makes the audience vulnerable. It makes the audience feel things in a way that you can't really accomplish in other, at least I cannot with the tools that I have. And it makes you vulnerable, and it makes you experience things in a more heightened way. And as an artist, that's really exciting to me. And so I think that is kind of like what attracts me a lot to that space.
Did you ever watch Bo is Afraid?
Yes. Yeah.
It's like I came out of that and I was like, that is the most horrible fucking movie I've ever seen. But in a good way. Well, in a way that was like he did exactly what he set out to do, and it was that's a real fever dream of a movie where it pisses you off and it's uncomfortable and you see things that you never ever thought you'd see, and and you kind of leave it like fucking I can't see the world in the same way, you know, like you're forever changed.
Exactly.
Because the worst
mission accomplished.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The worst thing that could ever happen is you leave a movie going like, what did I watch last night? What did I watch this morning? You know what I mean? Like, it just impression. Like, I watched him in the morning, because sometimes these exhibitor screenings are like first thing, which is sometimes a tricky thing to do. And also sometimes, and I've said this on the show, it's kind of tricky for me as the cinema, because it's often just me and like two or three other people in like what's sometimes a really big cinema. So I prefer and wish to see it with more people, but I do appreciate the lead up. But I left it, it stuck with me, you know, it was certain scenes, certain visual, you know, it's very visual in that sense, where it's like, it's very successful in its kind of art and how it's the colors and the lighting and just the direction of this. But it stays with you.
No, that's great. And, you know, and kind of like, you know, when you're able to do that, when you're able to make a film that people remember, and it makes the takeaway that much more valuable, right? And so, like, if you walk away from this movie thinking, like, you know what, I'd rather live a balanced life than sort of like, then concentrate so hard on one aspect of it that I lose everything else. Then that's great. That's the
takeaway.
That's sort of like, yeah, like that's, it's like, I'd rather just try to find balance in all that I do and try to be, you know, a part of that world. And that, you know, so it's like, it's what we call hiding the vegetables sort of thing. It's like, you know, there's okay. Nutrition, there's nutrition, there's like a message, but it's underneath some stuff. And so you don't notice it as much.
Okay. You know? Do you use that term in writing?
Yes. Yes. It's actually really important to everything that we do. Like the way that we talk about, when I say we, I mean, to up my company, it's like anything that we create, it's like, we're trying to find the intersection of intelligence and accessibility, which basically is like, we want to be talking about something. We want to engage with something, but also we want to do it in a way that people actually want to fucking watch.
No, you know? Of course. No, of course.
Or experience. And so like, and if the balance is off, is this, you're too preachy, no one wants to see it. And if it's too accessible, then you're not saying anything at all.
Yeah.
And so trying to find the stories that do both of those things is like sort of the mantra of all of our stories. Yeah. So, you know, also it's like, we have to devote years of our life to these things. And it's like, what do you want to devote years of your life to? You know? Yeah. So,
and I'm sure as a dad, you're very familiar with those kinds of meals that you have to serve your kids where you have to yes. present it like, hey, this is macaroni and cheese. You love macaroni and cheese. Meanwhile, there's like broccoli in there.
It's
like
yeah, exactly.
heavily disguised.
Exactly. Put enough cheese on anything is fine.
Lovely. What are some of the other phrases or the things that you kind of keep telling yourself or kind of keep in check? I'm always curious.
We asked if a writer friend of ours, her name is Kat Sandler. She writes out of Canada, and we met her. And the question came up, like, what's the best piece of writing advice you've ever gotten?
Yeah.
And she said, the best piece of advice that I've ever gotten is no one wants to read your fucking script. And that is the best piece of writing advice that I now have ever gotten, because if you keep that in mind, no one wants to read this. How do you keep them engaged anyway?
Okay.
How do you keep them turning the pages even though they don't want to be here?
Okay.
And that's a constant challenge that you kind of have to set for yourself, and it starts right away, right? Like yeah. you can't spend four pages in the very beginning just doing nothing, yeah. right? It's like you need to yeah. get people involved right away, so, and keep them there.
So him, at least the movie starts with the little boy watching this game, this yeah. footage on yeah. TV, staring at it, but. And it's this moment of kind of greatness and celebration, but there's an accident.
Yeah.
And so quite early on, the footage that this little kid is seeing involves football, greatness, celebration, but there's this moment where you see like a broken leg bone. Yeah. It's quite horrific.
Yeah.
Okay, was that in your original plan? Because that sort of brings the horror and the sort of body horror quite quick. I can imagine that being on the first page.
Yeah, it was absolutely in that world. And to me, the most interesting part of that scene is the father not allowing the child to look away from it.
Yeah, he's like, look at right? this, look, stare at this. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so like that to me says everything about this that we are trying to say, which is like, it's weird how much we put into this.
Yeah.
It's weird. Yeah. And what we pass down onto yeah. each other and what culturally we value and like that sort of thing was always at the heart of this yeah. project. Yeah.
I mean, all sport has it. And we, you know, you just hear it every 2 minutes in Drive to Survive. Where the Formula One drivers are just, I only want to win. It's all about being the greatest, and
yeah,
and you realize like those guys are sort of minuscule of seconds away from each other, but the one is considered the greatest of all time, and the other one's considered the bottom of
no
the
one.
Pit. But they are literally minuscules of a second apart from each other. But
yeah.
but it's a very American thing to sort of turn them into gods. Like, yes. Okay, maybe European, I think maybe it's international, but maybe the Americans are just better at advertising that. And
I think Americans have made it more their identity than anyone else on Earth.
No, like, you know, Italians will, you know, honor and celebrate and idolize, you know, football players, but it feels a little different. Every country has presidents, but the Americans count their presidents.
Right.
It's like, right. No, but no, the fucking country does that. Do you know what I mean? It's like, don't make them more than they need to be. They're just civil servants. Do you know what I mean? Like, and of course they can do good and they're important. I'm not discounting that, but it's like, you sort of, you know, you're making them sort of one of the gods, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, fuck.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's the culture of all or nothing. It's the culture of win at any cost. It's it is sort of like this toxic thing that feels very American to me. I know it exists in other places, but it's like, because this is what I know and live in, it's sort of like, it is this sort of disgusting way of dehumanizing people. Because if you value one person above all, that means you value other people less, right?
But it's also the Americans' approach to success and how the Americans would be very good and very confident in getting across over the course of just a minute introduction, like, oh, I'm a big deal. Where I think the culture in other parts of the world will be like, they don't say anything, but they could be like the king of Sweden.
Right.
And and you wouldn't kind of know. Where like an American success is just louder and it's more confident in telling you that.
It is the most valued thing.
Exactly. So it's the currency of America, and that's the seed of him, which is is like, are you gonna let that consume you?
Yeah. Yeah. That was always sort of like the thing that, you know, and it was also about a clash of generations, because I think that you're seeing that more often, that younger athletes are sort of like stepping away when they're feeling a mental health crisis overtaking them, which is entirely possible, you know, and you have these sort of like younger athletes speaking to like, I'd rather have balance in my life. I want to make sure that I'm healthy. Whereas you have sort of like the older generation that is like, nothing stands in the way of winning.
Yeah.
You know, like, and whatever you're dealing with is weakness, and you need to stamp that out because you're trying to win. You're trying to beat other people. And so that was interesting to us too. Like the sort of like those two mindsets colliding.
Yeah.
And the thing about those two mindsets colliding is that one overpowers the other pretty much all the time. Yeah. And that's how the cycle continues, you know?
Did you watch the Simone Biles docuseries on Netflix?
I didn't. I know her story, but I have not. I did not watch that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you know the story, but that was interesting to me, is how in the height of the Olympics, she was like, I'm out.
Yeah.
This is too much.
Yeah. And that's so human. That's so relatable. Like, how many times in your life have you just been like, I don't want to do this. You know, like, this is too much for me. Yeah. And it's fine. You know? And that's good. It's good to, like, make those decisions where you're just like, you know what? I don't want to do this. And it's okay.
I often think it's a little bit like a balloon. And if you can feel it's going to pop, you like, what can we do to just take a little bit of air out of this? You said you're busy writing this week. This visit to the video store is a nice little break between writing. What is consuming you at the moment? Where's your head at?
We're working on a new project that we're pretty excited about, that I don't want to talk too much about, but it's actually a movie that's a different genre. So it's like, it's more in the space of like Ocean's 11, it's more of an ensemble sort of like, lighthearted but not silly, you know. It's like, it's a movie with real people doing real things, but it's more fun. It's more funny. And it's a departure from him in a lot of ways, that has been a real exciting thing to sort of like engage in, you know?
Cool. Is it a bit of a heisty magic trick?
Yes.
You have to sort of.
Yes.
What you show the audience is part of the magic trick.
Yeah, exactly. It is very much in that space and pulling off a heist, but sort of like in a very unexpected way, in an unexpected world, I guess I should say. And it has been a lot of fun, and I'm really proud of it. And it's something that hopefully also becomes a movie someday, but we shall see.
Is it that spec script that you explained?
It is another spec script, but we have attached with a production company, and we've had an actor attached. So it's like we are starting to assemble the pieces to hopefully make a sale and get it going and do all that.
You know? Lovely. What's the next category in your movie club? What is your next movie that you're gonna watch?
So our next category that we're going to do is, we're all coupled up. So many couples are in this group. So the idea this time, we wanted to do something different, was you're selecting a movie that you wish your partner had seen, but has not yet.
Okay.
So it's like the movie that you're like, oh, you haven't seen this movie? You gotta see this movie. Like, that's the round. We're picking for our partners in that way. So that'll be fun.
So wait, is the idea that everyone is then gonna watch the same movie?
Yeah. So it's one person per week or every other week.
Okay.
And they pick the movie. We all watch it and then in our own time. And then we get on Zoom and we talk about the movie.
This is so cool.
Yeah, it was a great way to sort of keep in touch during the pandemic. It was like a really smart idea.
And is no one recording these conversations? Because that could be a podcast.
No,
maybe not everything needs to be commodified. But have you picked the movie yet?
No, because there are 12 people, I think, in the club, like I won't be picking until like 4 months from now.
No, but I mean, has this like, category for this next round, has the movie been chosen?
Oh, no, not yet.
The next
movie we're watching is Analyze This, which is the last movie in the jobs category.
Okay.
And then we're going to move on to the next round. Yeah.
Got you. Okay. So it's almost like the category is a season, and then everybody works their way around that season.
That's right. That's right.
I was at a wedding and I was quoting a lot of Wes Anderson with the guy next to me, and I realized my wife hadn't watched a lot of Wes Anderson, and I was like, I'm going to play you Life Aquatic, because to me, like, that was one of the more accessible ones. And I was like, it's one of my favorite movies of all time. Like, you should see this to understand me. And halfway through, it was such a great moment. She's like, it's weird. And I'm like, I guess it is weird. But like in a good way. But she was like, I hadn't realized how kooky and offbeat it was. Because for me, that was normal. And I was like, this is my radio station.
That's the aesthetic. Yeah.
I'm in this radio station. This is my frequency. This is normal and great to me. But for her, who's like, I love the fact that she's actually a little bit more of a normie. She's a bit more like, she doesn't care much for that. She's a horsey girl. So she's one of those people that like didn't, when I was watching movies, she was riding horses. And I just love it where she's like, it's a bit weird.
My wife is definitely more of a reader. Like she reads, she works in publishing. Like literature is definitely her life. And being a part of this movie club has forced her to engage with cinema in a way that she's never, and I think she appreciates that and she likes that.
Yeah.
But there are definitely differences in like our tastes and what we want. And so like picking a movie for her is interesting because it's like, you know, the movies that I love that she has not seen are stuff like No Country for Old Men Children of Men, you know, but it's very sort of like that kind of movie that I think she will appreciate and not enjoy.
Yeah.
And so it's like, how do you pick a movie I have to think about it. Like, what movie do I want her to see that I actually think that she would enjoy? Because I don't want to punish her. It's more just like, yeah.
Maybe consider Life of Chuck.
Yeah.
Because you've rented it so you can play it to her. But it's a very accessible, quite delightful, and also just odd and weird. And you sort of get it quite after the fact where you go like, oh, that's what that was. Doesn't kind of hit you immediately, and you go like, oh, I get it now. But it's a lovely, fantastical idea that sort of sits at the premise of it all. It's very cool. I think you'll love Life of Chuck.
Now that I've rented it, I have to watch it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I have to.
This is what we've said before. Like, in the video store culture, if you went all the way there, you paid good money, you brought it all the way back home, there wasn't much else to watch. Like, we actually sat through a lot more shit movies.
Yeah,
where
yeah.
today, if you're not feeling it, a little bit like nobody wants to read your script, it's kind of like nobody wants to stream your movie. And so you kind of, you can very easily just pause it, go to the bathroom, leave it, you don't finish it. It's quite a tough culture in that crowd, like now.
I got to tell you, it's one of the things that I am the most nostalgic for in my life. It's definitely like the thing that I miss most is just going to a place and staring at a bunch of movies and picking one and going home and watching it. And there was like such a beauty in that. You know, it's kind of the same way that I feel about going to bookstores. I love going to bookstores because it's just like you just go and you're looking at a bunch of ideas that people had.
Yeah.
And that's fascinating to me. People like poured their heart and soul into this thing, and it's a product, and here it is, and it's an idea.
Yeah.
And you can experience it and you can be moved by it. And that's so inspiring to me. And I miss that communal space. I'm glad bookstores still exist, but it's like the video rental store no longer existing in a mass way, I think is one of the tragedies of human civilization at this point.
No, I'll agree with you. And that's partly what inspired us sort of setting up this premise as the podcast, is to sort of go back and how those individuals behind the counter were the people that could really like enthusiastically go like, oh, if you love this, then you got to see this.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't exist. The algorithms, you know, work to some large degree, but it's not quite the same where someone's like, oh my God, dude, if you love this, then you got to see this. And so that's kind of what our spirit of the video store is aiming to be as a podcast, is that.
Yeah. Yeah. Context helps with everything. And it's just like, it's something that like the Criterion Channel does a good job of sometimes, when it's like they have like a collection of movies, but then they'll have like a featurette on like what these movies represent and what's a great example of them. And I think that's always really helpful to me, because it's like, oh, this movie is the one that I should watch to understand this. That's great. That's my sort of like entry point. And you're right. It's like that sense of curation, or that sense of like pointing you in the direction of something you're interested in, is like, again, something that I miss a lot, you know?
But just speaking on that, I think films like him will stand a test of time and will be good examples of this consciousness of mental health, and how this is an era of us challenging that, because everything up until now has been that, you know, win at all costs, which is fucking ludicrous.
Yeah.
And so now that we're challenging those things, these films are important. So you've added to that conversation, and you've done it on this big scale with this, you know, this great big movie. And so that's so exciting, man.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate you saying that.
And what's also very exciting is to now see where things go and stay in touch on things. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, because I think I know you got to get back to your writing, but I've enjoyed catching up, man. I've said to people whenever I spoke about the people I met in those years in that exchange program, I just said that these were folks that were giving up 6 months. It was about 6 months of living in New York to come to Johannesburg. Like, you chose Johannesburg of all places.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you have to be interesting. And you were, because, you know, none of my friends were just trying to write a novel.
Right.
You know, like, I didn't have any of those friends. I wish I did. They'd probably be more fascinating than the ones I did have. But, like, I just appreciated getting to know folks like yourself. And it was just so cool to then see you go on and get that success. So I've just been so happy for you with that, man.
Well, first off, I appreciate that. Thank you. And to me, when I think of my time in South Africa, I say this and I genuinely mean it, that I think that experience changed my life, but it also saved my life. Okay. I think in a lot of ways, I think that experience, it's funny because it's like when you do the travel abroad, you're like, I want to go someplace, at least for me, that I would never think to go otherwise. Right. Yeah. And sort of like be in a place that you can go to France, you can go to whatever, but it's like, to me, it's like South Africa. I have no, like, when would I ever go to South Africa? Like, what would draw me to South Africa? And so I'm proud of my, you know, whatever, 19-year-old self, like, having that kind of thought process, because it exposed me to things that I never would be exposed to otherwise. I forged friendships that, you know, last this day. But it also, like, made me step out of the bubble that I had sort of, like, built around myself unwittingly. And just immersing myself in a completely different culture really sort of like opened me up to everything in a way, and sort of like started me on a journey that I'm still on of empathy, of understanding, of being a citizen of the world, not just of America, you know?
No, sure.
And there's so much interesting history in your country, and so much conflict and so much anger but beauty and sort of amazing art and things created through pain that really just sort of like changed me as a person. And so like that was one of the more valuable things that I've ever done in my life, I will say.
That's lovely.
Even if it's like a place that you live and it just is every day to you. But it's just like
we needed that. You know? Like I needed that. I needed to and I craved, you know, meeting people from around the world, and I've been lucky enough to travel, but sometimes South Africans need foreigners to remind them why things are special, why things are weird, or why things are odd. And I think it was one of you guys in one of the programs where they took a look at this one. We got this really big casino complex that's modeled after an Italian village. It's called Monte Casino. And it's like, it's a little bit like a sort of something you see in Vegas, right? Like a sort of Caesar's Palace-y thing.
Right.
But we sort of just took it as like, hey, it's Monte Casino, whatever. Until like an American was like, this is weird. There's a little Tuscan village in the middle of four ways. Like, this is odd. And you're like, maybe it is odd. Maybe it is. And then the opposite, which is like, this is so special. You know, we've created this art, or we've seen this, or we've done this thing together, and we've challenged, and we've looked at this, or we find comedy in this way. And so it was lovely to meet you guys over the years and really get to know you. And sort of see a lot of South Africa through you guys, which I really appreciated.
Yeah.
But listen, man.
It's a special place.
Thank you. And I think let's end on that happy note. But let's keep in touch.
For sure.
If there's ever a journey out in the future with, I know you got kids, so perhaps at one day you guys should show them a safari.
Yeah.
Then you can always get in touch, and it'd be lovely to see you again. Otherwise, I'm on the cusp of fatherhood in the beginning of next year. And then, of course, all travel will cease for at least a few years. But then I can almost imagine myself, because my wife actually lived in New York for a few years doing her master's. And she's got friends who also all have kids. I've got friends like, you know, our mutual friend Dave has now got the most like beautiful little Korean baby.
And I'm almost, I
can imagine myself and Leslie, my partner, going on like a sort of world tour to sort of show off our baby to everyone. And this kid will have like big jaws with all the babies around, all the kids like roughly her age around the world. So maybe one day we can do that.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. Keep in touch. It was great catching up.
And thank you for the time.
Think about that time. Yeah.
Lovely, man. Cool. Get back to the writing. And hope all of this goes well. And yeah, we'll keep in touch.
Great. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Zach.
Bye.
All right. What a great chat. And it was such a treat catching up with him. There were a few questions that I actually had for him after the chat. It's always quite tricky in the moment to get to all the questions. And so I asked him these questions afterwards, and of course I now want to share that with you. The one was I never actually got him to explain where he got the name for his production company with Skip. This is 2UP Productions. And he said, this was his response. He said, a few months before Skip and I formed the company, we both watched an Australian film called Wake in Fright, and it sort of immediately vaulted to the top of whatever list we had for our favorite movies. It's just this bolt of lightning of a film, and it's something we couldn't stop talking about. There's an incredible scene in that movie where they play an Australian gambling game called 2UP, and I'm not sure how we landed on that exactly, but gambling on ourselves is an insane fashion that felt apt, and so that's where that name came from. The second question I had for him was exactly how many people had listened to the podcast. This is the Limetown podcast, and he said he doesn't know the exact numbers, but it's in the tens of millions conservatively, which is fucking incredible. And then I did ask, is there any way that we could see the show since Facebook Watch is no more? And he said he seems to think the only way to view the show at this point is to buy the episodes from Amazon or be on a domestic Delta flight in the US, which of course most of us won't be. He said it's also on Tubi, T-U-B-I, he thinks, which is an American streaming service. So yeah, it's not ideal that unfortunately the show is a bit tricky to get your hands on, but we appreciate the fact that it got made, and hopefully there's a way to have it live on for others to enjoy in the future. Magic, thank you for listening thus far. We have our home base, which is thevideostore.co.za, and we have other folks who have been all different other crafts, people who've written, who are musicians that do scores for movies, directors, producers. We love getting into the weeds of how all these different jobs can come together to make the films that we love. All right, we hope to see you again soon. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.